Okay, I'm very honored that our next speaker is going to be Steve Kalalia. Steve is a philanthropist whose work focuses on peace and sustainable development. He built one of Australia's leading publicly listed IT companies, integrated research, and established the Global Peace Index. The Global Peace Index is the world's leading measure of global peacefulness. He's the founder and executive chairman of the Institute for Economics and Peace, as well as the Charitable Foundation, one of Australia's largest private overseas aid organizations. Steve will be speaking about global cooperation to tackle problems associated with the Anthropocene. Because the sources of these problems are complex, he suggests new ways of thinking are needed to tackle these problems. Systems thinking avoids linear causality in explaining problems and suggesting policies. He suggests that systems thinking is a better way of understanding societal change. He will discuss the concept of positive peace and how it can help us conceptualize the way we think about peace in the Anthropocene. So join me in welcoming Steve Kalalia.
Well, thank you for the introduction. So this presentation's a new one. I haven't given it before, so let's see how it goes. But just a little bit of background maybe on how this all came about. So the Institute for Economics and Peace, we study peace, we then start to look at the factors which create peace or sustain peaceful societies, and we call that positive peace. Now, as we started to look at it, worked out looking at how it worked, what we could see is that the thing functions as a system. But then we started to look into looking at the way nations operate and work and started to try and find research which looked at analysing, let's say, the nation or the state from a systems perspective. There's virtually nothing. Now, we can find some stuff, maybe a little bit on judicial systems. There's some work on economics using systems thinking, but generally, there's not a lot. And so I think this is a great area which is open for a huge amount of research over the next 20 years or so and could have profound impact. So here we are, launching into something new presentation. So let's see how we go. Whoops, got the wrong one there. So the Institute for Economics and Peace, just give you a little bit of background maybe first up on the Institute. The Institute for Economics and Peace was set up to understand the intersection between business, peace and economics, places special emphasis on metrics to measure peace, and then to be able to prescribe an economic value to changes in peace. Placed two major products of the Global Peace Index, Global Terrorism Index, placed a lot of emphasis on marketing. So in the last 12 months, we've had about 10 billion media impressions globally. We've had about 840 million social media impressions out through our social media channels. Got five offices around the world, six offices now, headquartered in Sydney, Australia. Got offices in New York, Mexico City, Belgium, Brussels, The Hague, and we've just recently set up in Zimbabwe as well. So the work we've got is extensively used by the UN, World Bank, OECD, Commonwealth Secretariat. We do a lot of research, paid research for them as well. Got references now in over 3,000 books and got thousands of university courses which some of this work in some shape, way or forms included in. So anyway, that's enough of the commercials. Let's move into systems thinking. So I guess the first thing is when you're looking at, and I don't know how much the audience knows about systems, so for some of you this may be rather trivial, but for others it may be very, very new. So if we start to think of a system, there's really no generally agreed definition on what a system is. There's a number of different explanations, so we've sort of come up with our approach to it. So a system, first up, has more internal controls than it has external controls. So a good way as we start to think about systems as we're moving through here, think about yourself and your body, okay? And we'll say that societies are just an extension of the human psyche, so in many ways they're an extension of you and me. So the first thing's more internal controls than external. The second is has a clear defined boundary, okay? So like your body has a clearly defined boundary. And so we work, looking, let's say, a lot of the work we've done is based around a country or a nation state. So that has a very clearly defined boundaries. It has a lot of internal controls over what it does, as well as external inputs. And operates with a very high degree of complexity. So that's sort of the definition we use for a system. Now, we start to look at that. We do a lot of work looking at the nation, defining that as a system. You could look at the judicial system within a country, you could see that. You could use the education system, or you could define even a school as a system as well, which you wanted to work on. So now, as the internal boundaries and external boundaries start to break down, so question comes down, when within a society does something stop being a system? Is a soccer team a system? Or is a loose social network a system? So people attending this conference, and is this conference a system? So the boundaries and where it stops gets pretty difficult in many, many ways, but sticking at high levels, we can work with it. So I think the profound thing, and this is really a really profoundly different way of being able to approach thinking. So if we look at most governments, most organisations, we think in terms of cause and effect. So if I took the clicker, threw it up in the air, and come down and catched it, I catch it because it operates off physics. So if we look at the whole origination of empiric science, it's working off studying the physical world, okay? And so that is based on cause and effect. If I throw this up in the air and catch it, it's following a set of physical principles. So the effect has no influence on the cause. It will always be the same, regardless of how I catch it. Now, systems don't work like that. But if we look at the cause and effect and the way that's now flowed down through society, it influences, and the empiric way we think influences everything we do. Even the way this university structure, which Liz has had trouble in terms of getting interdisciplinary cooperation. So now, one of the fundamental things, systems, if you look at the whole, it's more than the sum of the parts. And so that's very, very different, because in a physical world, you break things down into ever and ever decreasing levels of detail. You run experiments to see how they work so that you can understand them. But a system, you can't deconstruct to its parts to understand. So this starts to create a radical transformation for the way we can actually view the way things operated, our interactions and societies. So for a university, as it breaks down into using, originating out of the science and empiric thought, as you break down the universities in different departments, they're like silos to understand the whole of what creation is. But what we find, and everyone in this room I think would agree, that if you start now looking into, let's say, just the publishing in journals, they're all around a specific discipline. It's very, very hard to get a full integrated and holistic approach in cross-disciplinary activities. So that's stuff we all know, but we can see it playing out. So now, just to drive it home, and I'll be getting into positive peace a little bit further on. So if we look at positive peace, it's constructed of 8 different pillars, if you like. And so if we look now at the correlation, let's say, with GDP or per capita income, what we find is the 8 pillars correlate really quite strongly with the GDP. But if we look at the overall score for positive peace, it correlates even stronger. We find that again and again and again as we start to look through different sets of correlations, whether we're dealing with levels of happiness, whether we're dealing with ecological measures and such. The whole of the pillars is a sum that's much more than their parts. So by coming back and thinking a little bit about the scientific method, so input, experiment, output, and then you do your research on, you get a result, and you keep repeating it again and again and again and again and again, and that way we build up knowledge. And so that's very, very good for the physical world, and it's not a bad approximation if we like for societies, but it's not enough. It's just not enough. Now, we start to think about, let's say, three different things within society. So let's look at well-functioning government, corruption, free flow of information, which could be a free press, but it's a little bit more. So does well-functioning governments affect corruption? Does corruption affect free flow of information? Does free flow of information affect low levels of corruption? Or are they all interdependent and move together? So separating them and trying to find causality, it's very, very difficult. And even if you do, it'll be different in different situations. So basically, really, if you want to understand and use a system, you've got to have some way of being able to approach it, which now comes in and is trying to work with the system without trying to understand the detail of every interaction. So if we're thinking of a system, we quite often focus on the events. If we think about society, we're quite often focusing on events. The election of President Trump. We see the event, and we go back and try and understand the cause. But President Trump really was a product of the relationships and flows of the society which had been coming about. Understanding the event and the cause will give us a partial understanding, but it's not enough to change the system. So systems lie in systems lie in systems. So if you look at the nations, it's within the international community, that's within our ecosystems and within the atmosphere. And if we look within nations, you can break that down into other systems like parliament, police, schools, etc. And so systems aren't, the components of a system aren't a hierarchy. The most smallest component can operate and influence the largest components, as we can see with, let's say, with the ecosystems. Now, we look at properties of systems. The first thing is their self-regulation. They seek homeostasis. So we get hot, we sweat. We get cold, we start to shiver. It's all about keeping the body within certain bounds. And societies, if you think about them, operate the same way. There's all sorts of what you can call encoded norms within societies. And we'll come back to a little bit of that further on. Systems are also path dependent. You can't actually take a system and go bang, take it on a radical trajectory and come up with something new without running great risks of breaking the system, which is most what this conversation today has been about when we're looking at the climate and the ecosystems and such. So it's important to understand the path the system's on when it's a society, and then working out how do you actually now nudge it or change it in the right direction. Radically changing it, you're like to break it, likely to break it. Think of the American Indians, the Australian Aborigines, or let's say the Tibetans in China today. They're in one path direction, modern society comes through and radically tries to transform it. Where do they end up? So encoded norms are what's used to maintain this homeostasis, and I'll come to that in a few seconds. Systems also, in particular with societies, are self-modifying. So if you've got persistent mismatch between your inputs and what the outputs are doing to try and correct it, then you're likely to end up with the system self-modifying to try and to adapt to its new environment. And these things can form virtuous or vicious cycles. So you've got your path dependence, you're moving along a path. And what's important is to understand the momentum or the velocity of the path and where it's going. And that, because it's a system, it's sort of self-regulating, it just keeps going. And so if it's on a virtuous cycle, it just keeps improving. If it's on a vicious cycle, then it's heading in the opposite direction. So and basically, systems are understood through mathematics. It's much harder to understand them through intuition. So now let's just take two things like encoded norms and intent, which we'll say make up systems. So countries have intent, just as individuals have intent. But if you look at international relations, you'll see a lot of talk about what countries are doing, but when most of it, it's all qualitative. It's good. Someone can show me some really decent, solid, research which is actually looking at maths or some other way of being able to understand national intent, I'd be very, very interested. We've done some work on it ourselves, but It's not something for this conversation, it's too short. So, we look at a system. You've got an input which comes into the system. Now, if it's within the encoded norms, it doesn't do much. If it's outside the coded norms, then it makes a response. And so examples of that be, let's say you had a outbreak of an endemic. The health system will respond by putting additional resources in to try and fix it. Outbreak of a conflict, you get a similar sort of thing. But if you get one homicide, the system will just keep functioning the way it is. Or if you get one death through some disease, again, it'll just keep functioning that like that. So when the mismatch comes, it goes back and tries to change the input. So it comes back to match what the system wants through its homeostasis and itself, indeed, through the homeostasis. And so, just as a simple example, so I'm sitting here, I'm speaking to the audience, and what'll happen, you'll get a different outcome each time, depending on where you may be. That might have to do with your background information as you approach this, might be of what you actually think of me, might even be your moods on the day. Societies are somewhat the same. The output and the reactions will be different depending on the different circumstances. So if we look at these historical paths, we're moving down, you can make changes. So if you're looking at the path and it's coming down, so you want to make small nudges continuously to try and make the changes to move the system in the direction which you want it to go. These big changes create big risks, but if you get to cataclysmic places, which we might be with climate change in another 20 years, then maybe you need to take those risks. But if you make the wrong changes, then you end up in a vicious cycle where you've got a reinforcing cycle, which is ever taking the system lower. Similarly, you can get systems stuck with a homeostasis, which is not healthy, or you can get a system stuck with a homeostasis, which is healthy. Now, we just come back and look at this simply. So if you take a process, you've got the assessment going on, you've got the feedback loops with the coded norms, and that just keeps processing and fixing things up. But if you've got a persistent mismatch, then the system looks at how can it modify itself to be able to fix that mismatch. And if you look within the US, you can see that going on today, and you'll also see it happening within, let's say, the British society and parts of Europe, is the system starts to get mismatches with the expectations of what society should be delivering and what it's actually getting. So that then causes modification, which creates a new encoded norm, creates a new homeostasis. So system changes, you can never go back. And once the system modifies, it's a different system than what it was before. So the comments like, make America great again, you can't take America back to the 1960s. You just can't do it. It's a different system. So now, also within systems, they're tipping points. So you can get small changes over a lengthy period of time, or changes over a lengthy period of time, and they don't have much impact on the system. Once you get to a certain tipping point, then that's very, very different. So that then can cause radical changes. So think a little bit like mercury or lead in your body. We can all take a certain amount, but once it passes a threshold, it's very, very detrimental on your health. It could be like a bird dropping a seed in a forest. Or it could be a new invention or a new idea, such as the arrival of mobile phones in society. And once, as I've said, once a system's changed, it can't ever go back to what it was. So let's start to look at a few tipping points which we can see within society. And there's a whole range of them we've isolated now. One was with the GDP and per capita income compared to peace. As peace increases, they've got an increase in per capita income, but after a certain point, it starts to go up very, 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 very dramatically. Now, we're not saying peace causes the increase in GDP, and we're not saying GDP causes the peace, because it's systemic, it's associated with a whole lot of other things. So we use an expression, causeless correlations. So as soon as we say I've got a correlation, the first thing people say to us, well, which one's causal? Not the way we're thinking. Corruption and peace. very, very similar sort of thing. Increased corruption without it having too much impact on peace. After a certain point, small increases in corruption have radically detrimental effects on peace. Find the same thing with relationship with inflation and peace. So you become less and less peaceful, less effect on inflation, but after a certain point, you find that inflation takes off. Similar sort of thing again, and again with inequality and peace. So she decreases the levels of inequality within a society, doesn't have a lot of effect on peace, just slightly up to a point, after which sort of very, very, very small increases in equality cause very, very detrimental effects on peace. So we're back again to virtuous cycles, back again to, to vicious cycles. So that slide went fast, didn't it? So, vicious cycle. So, thinking of society, we're thinking of the momentum and where it's going. This is going to get down into positive peace. Now, what, have you got the time, Liz? Because I lost the time when I started. I'm not sure how long I've been going. Just want to pace this now.
Yeah, 15 minutes.
Okay, great. Thanks. Okay, so we come back now. Adaptation and resilience as we're looking forward into the future is really key. So what's important about a system is its ability to adapt to change, and then also its resilience when it gets hit with abnormal shocks. So positive peace can be used as a measure of both resilience and adaptability, and I'll get back into that in a few slides. Democracies have the highest levels of positive peace, also the highest levels of wealth. And that's in large ways is because their ability to adapt and also to recover from shocks. So if we look at positive peace by government type, what we find is that full democracies have the highest levels of positive peace, followed by flawed democracies, hybrid regimes, and then finally authoritarian regimes. If we start to now look at income, so if we look at positive peace, what we find is the income, we find income groups have the strongest levels of positive peace, followed by middle income groups, lower income groups, and finally the lowest income groups. Similarly, if we start to now look at resilience, so one of the things we've done there is looked at civil resistance campaigns. So what we find, countries which are high in positive peace, they have less civil resistance campaigns, they last for a short amount of time, more moderate in their aims, more likely to achieve their aims, and far, far, far less violent. So now if we look at the problems facing humanity in the future, the major changes we're facing are all global in nature. And these challenges are systemic in nature. And so most of humanity really thinks in a causal way or in Darwinian terms. In other words, it's the survival of the fittest, which we all know is wrong. So we need to have new ways of being able to approach the way we think about the way societies operate and how they fit in with sort of the bigger challenges of our age. And so if we can really embrace the concept of systems and the way systems thinking for the way society operates, makes it easier now to fit in with the global challenges. We're more part of the system than something created independent of it and existing independently of the systems we're dependent on. Therefore, systems change would become easier if we could actually see societies as operating as systems rather than looking through a cause and effect type of paradigm. All right, move quickly into positive peace now and move it from there. So how do you arrive at positive peace? So you've got actual peace, we see that as being measured by the Global Peace Index. So we've run statistical analysis, you've got about 4,000 to 10,000 different data sets, indexes, attitudinal surveys, which we use. We find out the factors which are most statistically associated with peace. Now, that's great on its own, but what we can do then is by taking the attributes which are most statistically associated, using analysis, we've been able to statistical analysis, we can break them down into 8 different categories, and now we can turn that into an index. And the power of the index now is you've got the ability to be able to measure social change over time, and you're measuring it from a systemic effect. So if you go back to those 8 pillars of positive peace and the GDP graph, So what we can see there is the system is more than the sum of the parts. The sum of the parts in this part, the eight pillars. So now, if we look at positive peace, it's also come back and it's highly associated with a lot of things we think are important, like higher per capita income, stronger resilience, better environmental outcomes, higher measures of well-being, and better performance on the Millennium Development Goals. So these eight pillars, none of them quickly counterintuitive, but they all come together as a system. So well-functioning government, sound business environment, equitable distribution of resources, low levels of corruption, free flow of information, good relationships with neighbours, high levels of human capital, and acceptance of the rights of others. And as I said, you can't escape, can't work out the causality between it. So this has been, we've done about 8 years of this now, Global Peace Index, covers 163 countries. That's 99.7% of the population of the world. Use 24 indicators. Those indicators come from statistical analysis. The weighing of the indicators are dependent on the way of the strength of the correlations which we've got. So none of this is, any of it is my ideas or any of the researchers' ideas. As best we can, we empirically derive it. Now, it's a quick mud map of the world on peace. You'll notice that Western and Eastern Europe have got the highest levels of peace. You'll find North America's pretty high, Australia's well up, so is Japan. Africa has the middle, and Africa has the lowest levels. So just we'll look back quickly and just have a little bit of a feel for how positive peace has gone over time. So if we look at it, it's improved by 2.4% in the last 12 years. And that probably is a small amount, but it's pretty meaningless to most people. But to give you an idea, 111 countries have improved compared to 52, which has deteriorated. So two-thirds have improved. And that is a good news story for peace for the future. But I don't see anyone clapping and I don't see anyone smiling. It's contrary to what we've actually got in our heads as we do this conference. And sort of those improvements in that have been come about, mainly been driven by sound business environment and free flow of information over that time. The deterioration in that time, and only one of the eight pillars has deteriorated, and that was low levels of corruption. But as we look at this and unravel it, the story being a good news story will start to unravel into a not so good a story. So now if we look at positive peace over the last 12 years, what we see there is that it was improving, which we can see in what I've just given you there as the highlights, up to about 2013. Since then, it's been plateauing, and things don't ever plateau, they go off in a direction. So whether we're into about to have a step change, we've just had a hiccup in the improvement at this point, we don't know, but we can look at a little bit to understand it better. So if we look over the last 12 years, we find that sound business environments improved the most. Free flow of information, and that free flow of information, a lot of it has to do with the availability of the internet and mobile phones, because they're statistically highly correlated with peace, would you believe? Even though we are seeing the negative sides of social media today. Better relationships with neighbours, a lot of that's measured in things which are statistically significant there, and things like trade, signing up to international agreements, but corruption is the one which has deteriorated the most. It's the only pillar to deteriorate. But if we think corruption actually affects everything else, it's, if you like, an attractor basin in most societies. So now if we look at the regions of the world, Russia and Eurasia have had the biggest improvement over that period of time. North America has had the largest deterioration, and you're seeing that actually played out in the politics of the country now, and the Middle East and North Africa, a minor deterioration. So now let's look at that a bit further and break it down into the two sectors over the last 12 years, the part which has improved quite well and the part which hasn't. So this is what it looks like globally. So what we can see from 2013 to 2017, that great trend which was there for the 7 years before that, starting to reverse. Free flow of information is reversed. And that comes back mainly to a concentration of the press globally, and also in many countries a lot more, and it comes out of the security and the height and the back end of the war on terrorism, a lot of restrictions on a lot of areas of information within societies. Acceptance of the rights of others has gone backwards over that period of time, and that's happened, I think, in every region. And what we also find is low level of corruption. It's still there and getting worse. So we can see that we're in a different period. So things in the last 4 years have changed. So now if we look at the United States, now we look at that, compare it to the world, since 2005, what you can find is only two pillars there have actually improved. One's good relationships with neighbours, and the other's high levels of human capital. Everything else has gone backwards. So, and you can see it getting played out within the society today. So how does Europe look? Again, you look at the global average, and you look at the free flow of information, equitable distribution of resources, acceptance of the rights of others, functioning of your government, and the perception of corruption. So understand, corruption is only a perception, okay? It's the only way you can measure it, because you can't really measure the amount of money which is going into brown bags. So again, you can start to see that by analysing the positive piece, it does give you an idea of what's actually going to happen within society. So it's a view, it's a framework, being able to look into the society systemically. So I'm just, how am I going for time? I've got 5 minutes. I'm going to move really fast now. It's the first time I've given the presentation. There's a lot of slides in here. So just quickly, if we look at the per capita growth, we go back to 1960, we take the top 25 quartile of the index, bottom quartile of the index, compare them, you get about 2% higher GDP growth per annum on average, and that's huge. Now, as you start to look at this, you can see the step relationship in per capita and GDP growth. So now I've got a lot of slides here, so you can see the same thing with inflation, red is low positive peace countries. Got the same thing with interest rates. If we look at this here, blue is high positive peace countries. So what you can see, there's a very strong economic story tied in with positive peace, as well as a social story, which we've all been talking about. And we start to now look at positive peace, and we start to look at it, we find at different levels of peace, different pillars becoming, parts become important. So if you look here, the top ones, low positive peace countries, you find four of the pillars are really important. As you move to mid-peace countries, like, got more pillars come into play, but they're not quite as important. And then for high-peace countries, you find all the pillars become really statistically significant. So what we know from this work is we find that falls in positive peace precede falls in GPI scores. We also know that falls in positive peace precede falls in many macroeconomic indicators. And we also know that if you get improvements in positive peace, they also precede improvements in the Global Peace Index score. And similarly, if you get improvements, you get decrements in a positive peace, they'll cause decrements in the Global Peace Index as well. So now what I'm going to do in the last couple of minutes, just come back to some of the activities we're doing around this. And I'm going to give a very clear example of how you can apply positive peace thinking at a very, very low level in a rural community in Uganda. So we've got about 17 partners we're working with around the world which are implementing positive peace workshops. We've run them across all sorts of different societies. The framework we've got seems to be culturally neutral, which is great. So we're running with educated university students in most of the different regions of the world. And we've also run them down in areas of the world where 93% of the population has been illiterate. Currently in the process of training 1 million people on positive peace, and we're using the social network which we've got, which last year reached 820 million people, to pull people in to try and train them on it. We've so far trained 1,100 IEP ambassadors in 30 countries, doing training a new cohort at the moment, that's 540 new ambassadors, and the idea of that is that they can go out and give presentations around this stuff. And we're also in the process of developing master's courses. We're doing one with Banquerna out of a Barcelona, and so there'll be a master's course just purely based around what I've been presenting today, and so that'll be a first. So I'm just now, got to be finished in 2 minutes. Should be pretty much, I think, on time, Liz. How about that for a new presentation? So I'm just going to run through implementation of a project we did in Uganda, and we did it through Rotary. So Rotary have picked up on the positive peace framework we've got. They're rolling it. Peace is one of their major strategic thrusts for the next 20 years. And so they're rolling this training out through their 35,000 clubs around the world. So now, it was developed by a beautiful guy called Jade Kabuka. He used to work in the ministry, the finance ministry. He pulled out of that to become a teacher because he just wanted to go back, work close to people and help people. So that's what he did. So he did our training course on the positive peace in Kampala a couple of years ago. And so then, through his local Rotary Club, they had a literacy project they were running in a school there, which they've been running for a couple of years, but it wasn't really making a lot of difference. But they're putting the funds in, they were doing it, which was a really good job. So before implementing the positive peace framework around it, the project had about 50% of their students were achieving poor results. After the project, that jumped to almost 70% of students were achieving the desirable results they wanted. The number of students enrolled in the school jumped almost 40%. So quite a positive outcome. So now what I'm going to do is just step through what they did for each of these different pillars. So the idea is you take the school, that's your system, okay? You look at it through the lens of the eight pillars, and what is an intervention you can do in it for each of those pillars? And the idea of that is to stimulate the system so that you're actually moving it in a positive direction or a virtuous cycle. So for well-functioning government, sort of rather than the Rotary Club thinking what to do, they involved all the local community leaders on the planning and implementation committees for what they were going to do. So step through this, none of this is going to be original. It's all stuff everyone knows, and everyone in this room knows, but it's through taking a systemic effect, it's actually affected. So for a sound business environment, they decided to upgrade one of the classrooms, and that was because it had leaky roofs, but they put a lot of attention into sourcing the materials locally and employing people right within the very, very local community rather than bringing them in from further out. Equitable distribution resources was simply providing pens and writing material because this area was so poor, a lot of the students couldn't really afford pens, so they're writing with pens which hardly work, and they've got limited amounts of paper, so they're trying to reuse paper or writing on bits of paper like this until they're fully filled up. It's acceptance of the rights of others. So the girls, when they menstruated for 4 days, wouldn't go to school. So they introduced sanitary pads for the girls. That then brought them back into school. But more than that, this was part of the increased rates of attendance and increased scholastic rates. What happened then is they've got more interested in school. So their actual academic performance has improved. And so that was one of the bigger ones. But even bigger than that, and this is just, I just love this story, is the good relationships with neighbour pillars. So what was happening, this school's in a rural environment, so the kids at lunch would be going out and raiding all the fruit trees in the properties around them to eat. This was causing massive problems with the neighbours. They didn't want the school there. So now what's happening is the kids are hungry, okay? They haven't got anything to eat, so at lunchtime they go out and get some food. So what they did is plant some fruit trees in the yard, but then provided porridge at lunchtime for the kids. And the cost of the porridge is only a few cents for each child to get fed, so it's not even necessarily that expensive. So what happened now, that then meant the parents were more likely to send the kids to school, and because they had a meal at lunchtime, they had better concentration in the afternoon, so the scholastic rates went up. Free flow of information, they partnered with a local radio station to talk about the interventions and what they were doing. The high levels of human capital, they actually then sort of made sure they bought in and did medical checks on the kids so that they had the ability, and so the medical checks and then sort of the classroom reconstruction. So that was for improving the high levels of human capital. Checks, obviously, if you're sick, you can't concentrate, that affects your scholastic performance. And finally, the low levels of corruption pillar, anything which was donated to the school, what they did then is they put a little stamp on it, okay, so that if someone took it, a little stamp, big stamp, so if anyone took it, people would be able to see that it had gone, and set up a committee to actually monitor to where it went. So it's in the school about 12 months ago, and this is a couple of photos out of the school. So that's the school kids, and it gives you an idea of the rural setting and the background and just what the school looks like. That was one of the school room they were reconstructing. You can see the new roof in place there. The floor, what you can see there, that's pretty much the way the classroom floor will end up when it's complete. And you can see in the background one of the benches which they sit on to work. And there's the girls with their sanitary pads. Now, if you can measure and analyse peace, you can understand the factors which create peace. If you can measure and analyse peace, you understand the lost opportunity. That, my friends, is actionable, gives better prediction, better cost-benefit analysis, and better program outcomes. And that, my friends, is the end of the conversation. And if you're interested in finding out more, here's some details to go about doing it. Now.